When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Forever Dog.
Comic books, comic time. Writers and artists are on the line. They make a splash as a comic's read and take us on a trip behind the spread. Watch out for comic book commentary. Spinning a winning inside fix, how they got a hot idea. Narrative, character, visual tricks, and onomatopoeia. It's comic book commentary.
Hello, my name is Dan Abnett, and I've been asked to talk through the first issue of Rye from Valiant. I'm sitting here in my office in the UK. If you hear sounds in the background, it's either the last vestiges of Bonfire Night or Brexit's gone horribly wrong. Valiant came to me to write the new series. I'm very pleased to do so. I particularly like science fiction, coming from a sort of British heritage of 2000 AD, it seemed to be a strip that would suit me down to the ground. Originally, I was supposed to write the series coming off the back of the Fallen World event, which set everything up. And as it turned out, I ended up writing the Fallen World event anyway. So I had built my own foundations for this series. The premise is that we're several centuries, several thousand years, in fact, into the future. And most of humanity lives in a seeming paradise in orbit, looked after by Father, who is an AI construct, who is apparently benevolent and looks after things brilliantly. And his son is Rai, who is a partly synthetic warrior designed to protect the people of Earth. Over the years, Rai has discovered that Father is not as benevolent as he might first appear. It's a fairly dystopian future. He's very, very controlling. And eventually Rai rose up and faced down Father. And ultimately in Fallen World, just before Fallen World, we saw that he brought the orbital crashing down to the surface of the Earth in an effort to destroy Father and free human race. And in Fallen World, we saw how he was struggling to help them rebuild. Most of the humans, and indeed the positronics, who are human form synthetics, most of them regarded him as somebody who had sort of liberated them from heaven. They weren't necessarily particularly happy about their new state, even though Rai knew they were much better off the way they were. In Fallen World, Rai discovers that Father has survived. He's survived in the form of things called the Offspring, which are sort of mini versions, mini backup versions of him. And he has scattered those across the surface of the Earth, and if he collects 12 of them, he can restore his full AI consciousness. So Rai, having felt that his work was done and had renounced violence, is now set out on a quest to find and destroy as many of these offspring as possible to make sure that they don't resurrect the threat of Father. So Rai, in the ongoing series, is roaming the Earth, and he's doing so in the company of Rai Jin, who is a prototype Rai, and actually an older model, a previous version, but Rai Jin appears to be a young boy. So we have the odd effect of Rai's older brother looks like his younger brother. The two of them form an odd partnership. Rai Jin was sort of a publicity machine designed to resemble a small boy. He's very capable, quite powerful in his own right, and most particularly he has the ability to track the offspring. So they have this mutual reliance to get the job done. Rai Jin gives us an opportunity to, gives me as the writer an opportunity to examine Rai's nature and to have some quite amusing conversations between the two of them. So it's sort of a road movie. It's a buddy-buddy story, and the star of the show really is the strange Earth that they're investigating. As I said, this is the very far future. This is the year 4000 and something AD. it's a very far future world that has been left alone for a long time and has developed in its own ways. So essentially the brief was almost anything is possible. There are weird communities, there are weird high technologies and low technologies. It does not resemble the world as we know it. And therefore, almost everything is possible. Anything is possible. In the series, what I wanted to do to begin with was to do sort of standalone issues that were individual adventures where interesting things might happen, to set up a sort of narrative rhythm, to sort of reveal to the reader the sort of strange things that is possible to encounter here on Earth. However, there is a meta story growing in the background that will become apparent as the issues progress, and then we'll get slightly longer story arcs that links those things together. But it's picaresque in the old sense. It's a journey. It's a travelogue. It's a quest. In many respects, it's very mythical, which an aspect of it that I quite liked. And we're dealing with Rai himself. He has, as I said, renounced violence, although he's more than capable of producing it at sort of superhuman levels. And he sort of really, really wants to learn more about his human side rather than his synthetic side. He's very much anti artificial life and artificial intelligences after the trauma having to deal with father and the legacy of father. So in this first issue, I wanted to drop the reader right into at the deep end and begin as we mean to go on with sort of craziness and strangeness. I'm working with Juan, the artist, Juanjo, as we refer to him, who is simply superb. It is always a great pleasure for a comic book artist to get the pages in, get the art in as an issue gets drawn, and see these pages arrive and see what has happened to the script and what it's going to look like. And it is essentially always a pleasure. I've had the honour of working with some great artists over the years. Juanjo has just blown me away. The first pages of this came in, I couldn't believe what he was doing in terms of the detail, the storytelling, the characterization, everything about it is phenomenal. I said in an interview recently, actually, that as far as I'm concerned, the reason to buy Rai is the art alone. It is phenomenal. I hope the story's good too, but the art is simply stellar. And one of the nice things about it is that Juan has to me, it really feels like he's bought into it as much as I have. I've put quite a lot of effort into it, imagining this world and imagining the relationships and the characters involved in it. And he has done the same with the art. In fact, sometimes he's giving me visuals that surpass anything I've asked for in the script, which has allowed me to go back then and develop things further on. So later on, in some of the later issues, there are strands that have evolved that have come about simply because he's drawn something so incredible that I've wanted to follow up on it. In this first issue, we start slap bang with a splash page or a large splash image of this sort of wasteland community that has done the most sort of extraordinary things, erecting these wrecked machines as warning notices. I wanted to start with the sort of that note of the surreal, almost a sort of a visual gag, because what I wanted to do in the first few pages is really establish our main characters of Rai and Raijin, and to show, first of all, Raijin's innocence and a very matter-of-fact approach to things. He's sort of not very, very conversant with how to deal with human beings, particularly sort of feral human beings. And also I wanted to establish Rai's sort of diffidence, the fact that he's got a mission, he's on a mission, he's got this mission in his mind, and he doesn't really want to be delayed, and everything is slightly frustrating when something delays him that seems to be sort of inefficient or sort of not economic. So we drop them in there. They've clearly, it is revealed within the first couple of pages, they have broken down. Their transport's broken down in the middle of this desert, close to this community of dangerous looking individuals. And whilst Rai is attempting to fix the vehicle, Raijin confronts the people who are approaching them. So we get this great sort of, as I say, I think wonderfully surreal image, downplayed with a sort of a single line gag. And Raijin does his best to handle the negotiation, really, with people who are twice the size of him and armed to the teeth. I wanted Rai's reveal to be very, very cinematic. In fact, all of it, all the way through, I've tried to be cinematic. I've asked Juan to do as many page-wide panels as possible to get that widescreen feel. And there is a sort of I hope sort of spaghetti westernish sense of Rai's reveal. He's working on the car, as we see on the second page. He's working with the hood up, and sort of we only really see him when he steps out from behind this. He's talking before that, but he steps out from behind that. I wanted that sort of slow reveal, that kind of laconic reveal. And in the dialogue, there are little points that the dialogue said by the outlaws is very colloquial, and Raijin's is more precise. And he says, for instance, he says, by way of explanation, he says, "Our vehicle erred, and we're fixing it," using the word "erred," you know, sort of incorrectly. But he's talking about it, you know, sort of a machine talking about another machine. I wanted to build their personalities like that as quickly as possible. The negotiations, needless to say, do not go well, and it's essentially page three before we get the moment where Raya reluctantly reveals himself and realizes he's got to do something about it. Then again, there's a little bit of I hope cunning exposition, in as much as the disguised exposition. That is to say that we learn a little bit more about the world and the fact that some of these people have heard of the Raya and the synthetic warriors of New Japan. But they believe they're myths. So I was trying to seed a little backstory, a little clues for new readers who've not read anything before as to what's going on and who these people are. The outlaws take great delight in sort of roughing Raijin up a bit, and Rai sort of encourages him to deal with him himself. So we get this sort of Astro Boy moment where Raijin uses his robotic abilities to leap around and be superhuman, which serves really just to rile the antagonists up, which is not a great start for anything. Again, amazing visuals there. There's sort of the sense of oppression as the outlaws gather around, the menace of them, the fact they sort of literally overshadow Raijin, I think is some great work there. Rai, meanwhile, goes back to just fixing his car, just as sort of not really bothered. There is an element of the callous about Rai, which we're going to explore further as we go along. But unfortunately, he sort of sees Raijin as an instrument, as a useful tool, not really as an individual with his own rights. And that becomes a point of real friction between the two of them as they go along. As Raijin gets into trouble and is beginning to be overwhelmed, again, Rai's coaching him because he doesn't really want to get involved in the fight himself. So Raijin uses more of his powers, including sort of his ability to effectively levitate or fly, to further sort of anger and outrage the outlaws who are gathered around to do away with him. And eventually his abilities prove to be so superhuman that the outlaws flee in terror. This moment of Raijin levitating, which seems very minor, is going to prove to be very much more important as we go on later on, in actually through the next few issues, because Raijin and Rai are operating sort of undercover. They don't want to be detected by any of their opponents, like the Offspring, so they are trying to use their powers and abilities, their positronic powers and abilities, as little as possible, so that they won't be detected. So this is a sort of a momentary slip that will have consequences later on. It's worth noting, although it doesn't have a huge bearing here in the first issue, that the big villain in this series is the one we set up in the Fallen World crossover, which is that one of the Offsprings has managed to possess the body of Bloodshot, who is still around in this future world, and his nanite body is a perfect host for the Offspring, and he's become this figure called the Bloodfather, incredibly dangerous, who is also collecting Offspring to make himself more powerful. So there is a clock ticking through this series as Rai and the Bloodfather both quest to get to Offspring first, and every time the Bloodfather does that, you know, he gets more powerful. So that's part of the meta that's running underneath this. We spend a little time after the outlaws have been scared off, watching Rai and Raijin discuss their quest and the nature of their relationship. It's sort of, again, a little bit of recapping for new readers. I wanted to be a very naturalistic dialogue. I wanted to make it feel like a natural conversation, but I also wanted to fill in the gaps without it being, you know, heavily expositional. I didn't want that moment where, you know, Raijin says, "Well, as you know, right," and then proceeds to explain something that, of course, they wouldn't need to talk about because they knew full well. So I hope that sort of thing works. I think it's made infinitely more effective by the character acting that Juan has brought to the art. The characters look terrific. As we move through the issue, they stop and rest for the night. And during that night, Rai has a dream. He takes his dreams to be evidence that he is more human than machine. And he dreams of the love that he believes he's lost, Momo, who he believes is still out there, that he's secretly questing for. So his quest is sort of double-edged. He has the great courageous humanitarian quest of dealing with the offspring, but he also has a personal quest along the way, and he sort of needs to keep those things separate. There is, I think, an air of slight menace about the dream, that that Momo, although it is his heart's desire and is affectionate towards him, she sort of seems to be withholding information and almost steering him. And I think that we're already setting up the idea that that things in Rai's head, or things that are influencing Rai's mind, are perhaps not as sympathetic as they might be. Again, with that sequence, Juan is using the art to convey that, the regularized or semi-regularized page wide panels, the cinematic feel we've had there breaks down during the course of the dream. So we get smaller and more intimate panels, handled in a rather different way to express the fact that this is a different state of being. Quite apart from the fact that Rai looks like his old self rather than his current self, but there is another great example of the visual storytelling matching the atmosphere of the story itself. By the midpoint of the issue, we have had our heroes arriving at what is essentially a truck stop. It's an almost old school, what we in the UK would call a petrol station or garage, a service station in the middle of nowhere that is sort of serving the community. It's got a bar there. Again, the surreal nature of this, we're not really explaining. We're just saying these sorts of things can happen. This is clearly some kind of trading post that people visit for fuel, for food, for drinks, whatever. It's got a very old school barman behind the counter with a bow tie and a waistcoat. These were the sorts of ideas that I was throwing at Juan and saying, you know, let's just make this, you know, it makes a certain sort of sense, but we don't need to explain the full detail of that sense. We just accept it for what it is. So they sit and sit and have a drink whilst their vehicle is being repaired and fueled. Rai is trying to be human, but again, he seems very clumsy at it. And at this point in the story, we realise that the outlaws from the opening scene have not given up and are coming back seeking a great deal of revenge. So it would have been easy at that point, unconventional, shall I say, to just have the rest of the issue be this tremendous battle where Rai himself is forced to deal with the outlaws rather than leaving it to Rai Jin, and we then get to showcase his immense power and might. But I wanted to do it again in a slightly eccentric way, which I think works really, really well. I hope the readers will agree. But when Rai realizes that there is trouble coming, he leaves Rai Jin at the bar and goes outside to deal with himself. And now this bar area has got enormous picture windows looking out into the desert, so we can see the outside, although it's separated from us. So for the next sequence, which I think is particularly tremendous, Rai walks out into the open. We see that in a tremendous splash image where he's facing this onrushing army of outlaws, very sort of, I suppose, very Mad Max, but there's also sort of animatronic dinosaurs being ridden towards him. I mean, just about everything horrible you could possibly imagine coming his way, and he calmly walks out to face them, as if not bothered at all. Meanwhile, inside, Rai Jin is sitting at the bar, enjoying his drink, chatting to the bartender. The bartender's getting increasingly worried and flustered about what's about to happen. He's never seen the outlaws gather in these strengths before. He's not quite sure what's going to happen, except that he's pretty sure that that his two customers are about to die horribly, and then he'll probably die along with them. So what we get from that point on is this conversation between Rai Jin and the bartender, which again covers some exposition, although it's quite personal exposition, and it's natural exposition again, which is what I was striving towards, because the bartender doesn't know anything about this, so Rai Jin can legitimately explain this all to him. And once that's happening outside, Rai is just going berserk and taking down the opposition in the most spectacular way. This was one of the areas that that I had this idea up front about how I wanted that to happen. And I described it in the script to Juan to see if he could do it. And I think he's done it amazingly. So first of all, as I say, we see Rai walk outside to face the mob. And then we're back inside with the people drinking in the bar. And the conversation's going on. And the first we realise that anything is going on outside, the first we realise that the wheels have come off, is that we see bodies flying past the window. The bartender reacts, but Raijin doesn't. So I love this idea that we've got this, you know, this incredibly spectacular fight going on, but we're sort of, it's sort of happening in the background. There is something surreal, there's something, I think, quite essentially comedic, but there's also something quite realistic about that, because the focus of the story is this conversation, and outside we see all manner of terrible things happening. When we finally move outside, I there was something I wanted to do, as I said, I put it in the script and to see what Juan would do with it, and he's done the most amazing job. I wanted it to look as though Rai was barely moving. He's clearly fighting. He's clearly taking out these people en masse. He's shredding vehicles. He's hurling people into the air. He's taking on dinosaurs. But he's moving, this was my suggestion, he's moving at such speed that we don't really see the blows that he's striking. He essentially appears just to be walking forward with his arms at his side, because everything else he's doing is happening with such snap speed that it's invisible to us. It's moving too fast. So we have this bizarre and I think brilliantly drawn action sequence where Raijin just walks through, just walks through this thing with chaos happening around him. And we realize that he's causing the chaos. It's just that we can't see him causing the chaos. The detail, the momentum, the dynamic, the storytelling in this, I think, is extraordinary. I mean, Juan's done a brilliant job up to this point, but this is really amazing stuff. He's done slight blurring around the figure to suggest movement, the sort of subliminal movement that we can barely see. We see this incredible kinetic impacts happening all around him, where Rai is just moving relentlessly and remorselessly forward. I think it's terrific. It's sort of, like I said, it was this idea I had in advance. I thought, would that work? Is that gonna be effective? I'm not sure. And I was prepared to scrap it and go more conventionally if Juan came back and said I can't make it work, or he drew something that we agreed, you know, wasn't really getting the point across. But I think he has just done it brilliantly. I think it's terrific, and I think it sort of makes the sheer scale of the violence that Rai is dishing out all the more shocking. He's not just a superhero. He's not just an unstoppable warrior machine. He goes beyond the point of simple superhuman heroics to a point where there is something terrifyingly controlled and calculating and all-powerful about him. And that's kind of what I wanted to do, and I think that, because I really wanted to reflect the idea that that's how Rai feels about himself. He's sort of afraid of himself. He knows exactly how powerful and devastating he can be, and exactly what sort of monstrous carnage he can dish out, and he therefore is restrained. It's sort of, I suppose, going back to many stories, particularly classic stories of martial arts, where the martial artist knows that his slightest movement he can do something devastating to another human body, and therefore tries to remain completely calm and tranquil and not to rise to provocation or anything like that. And that's really what is happening here, is that Rai is really resistant to this. He wants to follow a path of peace. He's only doing this because he must, and he's the one to do it, not Raijin. And so he does it, but he does it with a kind of clinical efficiency, which inevitably causes chaos, but he does it with his clinical efficiency. So I sort of really wanted the back half of the issue to show us the Rai that Rai himself is afraid of being, because I think that's quite an interesting idea. Anyway, so the action then continues quite spectacularly, and the bartender is increasingly horrified by the sorts of things he's seeing. Raijin is just continuing to enjoy his soft drink and be amused by the story he's telling. He's not bothered. He's seen all this before. He knows what Rai is capable of. This is not a spectator sport for him. He doesn't need to look. He knows it's being dealt with. He's not even, you know, ghoulishly fascinated in the nature of the devastation that's being wrought. He's very matter of fact. So I think that in the course of this very simple very, very simple sequence, which is essentially an action sequence to showcase Rai. We have established a great deal about Rai's character and nature and his personality. We've established a great deal about Rai Jin's character and nature and the relationship between them. And we've also got the bartender there as a witness, being absolutely appalled at both. He's appalled at Rai's violent nature, but he's also appalled at Rai Jin's sort of apparently dismissive, disinterested attitude to it, which I think is very effective. So we're using a scene that does one obvious thing to establish about four or five other things about who these people are and how they operate. Again, I'm just looking at the artwork in front of me here. The action sequence is extraordinary. I could think of very, very few artists who could put in that kind of level of detail, the sort of collateral damage and the debris spraying around. It's just extraordinary. I do think that this is a book that people will, I hope, adore simply because of the consistently high quality of the art. And because we've been working on it now for many months in advance, it's wonderful to work for Valiant, because Valiant is a company that believes in putting issues in the drawer and not just sort of chasing down every deadline that comes. We've been working on this for some months. We are quite a long way in. So we've got a good long run of us together, the two of us doing this book, rather than needing to rotate our teams or find fill artists. It's terrific. I think it establishes a great consistency as the series progresses. So rest assured that if you read the first issue and you like it, then that's what you're going to be getting. You're not going to get a couple of issues of that and suddenly it will change style to a different artist, and which I think is always a let. Doesn't matter whether the different artist is equally good. If you want a book to look and feel the way in a particular way, if you're getting used to it, the last thing you want is it to change style unnecessarily. So yes, devastating panels of action, insane levels of detail in the art. Lovely comedic touches of the interior shots with things flying past the window outside, suggesting even greater feats of daring and violence. And we see people at one point, outlaws running away, firing over their shoulders in panic because they realise they've bitten off more than they can chew. I think those things are very cool. In fact, in some respects, there's sort of more menace happening inside the garage than there is happening outside, because outside the menace is entirely manifest. You know, clearly Rai is tearing them apart, so there's no doubt at all what's menacing there. Inside, there is a much more contained menace in Rai Jin. The bartender is spooked by talking to this little robot boy who's saying these slightly distressing, unnerving things, to the point where the bartender even fears that Rai Jin is going to turn on him and kill him. He's not, but Rai Jin doesn't necessarily read that. He doesn't read those human emotions. He doesn't read the anxiety he is building in his host at this point. He's simply talking frankly. He's got no filter. He just says things very plainly, and because he says things plainly, they have a habit of alarming people. So he explains in this sequence of conversation what the offspring is, the nature of their quest, and the nature of their relationship together. And he does so, as he says at one point, he says, "I've studied pop culture bartenders, and they're portrayed as good listeners." He justifies what he's doing because he's read this guy as a bartender and assumes that part of his service is to talk and hear his customers' inner thoughts. As they're sitting there having this conversation, and again, with this almost comedically insane violence happening outside the window, silently, by the way. Everything that was happening outside the window, I wanted to be silent. So there are sound effects when we're out in the open with the fight, but when we see it through the window, it's just happening like a back projection. We don't hear the sounds from outside, as if this glass is insulated. I think that, to me, that's just very, very funny. I don't know why. Maybe I've just got a very sick and twisted sense of humour. But as they sit there, Rai Jin experiences a sort of tingle, a flash, which we manifest as a sort of a special effect, which means that he's just picked up the trace of another offspring, and essentially they've now got a scent. They've now got their first clue they need to follow to find the next stage of their quest. So he thanks the bartender and walks outside just as Rye finishes. And there's a wonderful sense of Rye decelerating to normal in that final panel as the last of his opponents collapses around him. And again, he's not broken a sweat. He's completely calm about it. He's just done what he needed to do. Rye walks outside and says, "I've detected a trace we must set off." And Rye goes, "Okay." It's as simple as that, completely matter of fact. And they literally walk back to their repaired vehicle as the dust just plumes around them from the aftermath of this fight, which we pull back on. Juan again doing some amazing cinematic scale there to show us the appalling, I mean, sort of battlefield levels of devastation left in the wake. You know, we've got tankers on their sides, burning vehicles, bodies everywhere, a dazed-looking Tyrannosaurus Rex staggering away. I think we've even got a downed Triceratops at one point that's lying there like a slaughtered cow. It's a very impressive image, and again, it's blending all the things that we wanted to blend. You know, the scale, the cinematic feeling to it. The definite nature of SF and also of surreality, it's sort of all contained there. Everything that you're going to get out of this series is sort of locked there in that image. Is that the you know sort of this bizarre blending of elements that nevertheless make some kind of weird sense. And that's not to say that future issues will be exactly like this, although we are going to meet some dinosaurs again later on. I'm just for dinosaur fans out there, we are these positronic dinosaurs are roaming around like the escapees of some futuristic Jurassic Park. But we're going to meet all sorts of different things. I think the important thing is not that everything in this future Earth is going to look like this. But this is a statement of intent in terms of the sheer range and variety, the potential of the future Earth. In fact, next issue, we get some amazing visuals that are completely different. At the very end of the issue, we have our sort of coda final page where we do what all good comics do, which is flash briefly to the looming menace of the villain, the Red King, the Bloodfather, who is monitoring this in his palatial residence, and he has detected the signal from the early part of the issue, and he has realised that he's finally located the individuals. Raijin and Rai are the only two people who can possibly thwart him in his quest, and therefore he begins to mobilise his forces against them. So this is setting up stuff that will happen in the next few issues, bringing our antagonists and protagonists sort of head to head in a rather more direct clash. This world is as I said, a dangerous and bizarre world where there are going to be plenty enough dangers for Rye and Raijin to face anyway. Just their random encounters, their chance encounters in the course of their quest are going to give them problems. But Bloodfather himself is a much more directed threat, hostility towards him or towards them both, which will manifest as we see that hunt taking place over the next couple of issues and then building to an extraordinarily bloody climax around about the end of our first arc, so around about issues 4 and 5. I think it's I'm delighted with the first issue. I would say that I wrote it. I'm delighted with the first issue because I think it looks amazing and it sets the scene for what each issue is going to do, which is look extraordinary. I can't praise Juan highly enough. I think he's doing the most extraordinary job. I think there are little touches of detail that just make this feel incredibly real, incredibly well realised. His style is very, very distinctive as well. I don't know. I'm just so excited to be working with him. I think the story is decent enough. I think this is a great introduction to the characters and to the nature of what this series is going to be, and to the dynamic that we're going to go on, that we're going to obviously further explore. And it sets us up, as I say, for the issues to come, where next issue we have what is technically speaking an extremely quiet issue, but equally eerie. It's another episode on their trek. One of the things I discussed with Liza, the editor, is we're thinking back to the classic TV shows, particularly the 60s, citing Star Trek, the original series Star Trek, as a good example. Just the idea that each episode was its own thing. The crew of the Enterprise would arrive somewhere and do something, and that would be that story. And we wanted to do that a little bit with this, is that the nature of this earth is so varied. There are so many different enclaves and societies, and they're sort of, some of them don't know about their neighbours, and that they could be very, very different from one community to another. And also we have, of course, all the different sectors of New Japan that have recently crashed here. So we've got whole areas that are sort of flavoured or attuned to a particular thing. We might have a sector that was ancient Rome or something like that, so we sort of have these theme park type areas like the ones that contain the dinosaurs that dominate whole areas of the landscape. So there is this great sense that their trek will take them through different areas where each time they will encounter radically different things. I hope that's a very enticing thing for the readers. I hope that will keep you hooked. As I say, we've tried to realize the world as well as possible. We've tried to introduce a good, strong flavor of science fiction, perhaps with a slightly satirical edge to it. But it's nevertheless, real. It's not a joke story at all. However, there is human comedy coming out of the characters in places, particularly Raijin, which I think is a great relief from the seriousness and from the sheer menace of the chief villain, and from Rai's own seriousness. It's quite difficult to balance a character like that because he could simply be the sort of unsmiling samurai warrior, could be tremendously unsympathetic to the reader. I think he is surprising, because I think even from this early stage we're getting a sense of his inner conflict and his own sadness, and if nothing else, it's sort of his own guilt about what he's had to do, and the fact that nobody really understands why he's had to do it, and that he's done it for the best reasons, but people hate him. But certainly Raijin is almost as an extension of him, that the two of them forming one character, in as much as Raijin is the voice of his conscience, the question, Rai's questioner, and really, although they sort of dismiss the idea that they are brothers in any biological sense, that there is a fraternity between the two of them that allows Raijin to comment on Rai, and in doing so, the reader to understand more about Rai. So what would be grim and unsmiling if Rai was on his own is nuanced by the presence of Raijin. And I think there is also, as I said earlier on, there is the question about exactly where that relationship is going to go, and the fact that there is, in the same way that Raijin can accidentally create a sense of menace when he's talking to regular humans just by having no filter, there is also a slight sense of menace, is that we don't ultimately know how sympathetic Rai is going to be to Raijin as they progress. That will he consider him still to be a tool, an instrument, just a useful thing to have around, a device, rather than a friend, or indeed as a brother, or as a life worth preserving and looking after. Bearing in mind that back in Fallen World, Raijin was very much part of Bloodfather's sort of personal army. He not by choice, but he was working with the Bloodfather because he didn't necessarily know any better, and only changed sides when he realised quite how terrible Bloodfather was. But I think there is an essence there that Rai, who is very honourable and very precise about these things, possibly doesn't yet know if he can fully trust this strange robot boy that he's obliged to work with, because he's changed side once, and his Rajin's first inclination was to work for the worst possible person. It is that their relationship is a work in progress, and indeed probably is the core of this series. The nature of their relationship, the nature of any kind of potential bond of affection or fraternal love may or may not develop as we go along. So the road trip, this science fiction, violent science fiction road trip full of incredibly weird stopovers and strange rest stops, is the vehicle of the transmission as we tell the story of their quest and of the relationship. So if I was going to be very kind of like high concept about it, the quest isn't really to find the offspring, although of course it is, because that's the whole point of the adventure. But the quest really is whether they find themselves or find each other, and what the nature of that relationship is. But that, like I said, is far too high concept. It's a great adventure story. It's about two robot dudes traveling the world, having adventures, trying to save the world from itself, and trying to stop a menace that is absolutely unbelievably horrible. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you certainly enjoy the astonishing artwork. We have put a lot of thought and effort into this. I hope it shows that we've tried to give it a flavour all its own. There are a lot of great comics on the stands out there, and you've got to try and make your mark in a distinctive way to arrest your audience. And I hope that this does. I think there's a lot. I think it's the sort of thing you could look back on several times. It's not a read it and then toss it aside thing. Just going back to look at the small detail and the background elements in the art, I think is worth it. And there, as I say, although it's a series of standalone episodes to begin with, there is a building momentum. There is a meta story that's gathering pace, even when you're not really aware of it, so that we're really going somewhere, and we've got sort of more major points of punctuation in the series, so that there is a sense of story arcs and bigger things happening and momentous things happening. And we're going to start to introduce some other supporting characters as the series progresses, both characters that you will recognise if you've read this strip or other Valiant strips before, which is going to be fun. And also a couple of brand new characters that I think we've created especially for this world and for this story that I hope have longevity and that you will like a lot. There's one, in fact, and this is way in advance, but by the time we get to sort of issues 5 and 6, there is one character there who was a perfect example of what I was talking about the collaboration between myself and Juan, in as much as it was a temporary character, a character needed for a short period of time. But when that character got on the page, I realized that I liked the character so much that I could suddenly see them becoming far more pivotal to the way the story progressed afterwards. And we sort of revised what I wanted to do in order to include them and to make the story flow with that. I think that's always a good sign when you always plan out a series in advance and you have issues lined up and a working outline for the first year or whatever else like that. And if nothing else, you need to show that to the editor in order to get approval to start work. But I think you're never going to have all the good ideas you're going to have on day one when you're writing that outline in advance. And it's got to expand and grow and evolve as you work into things. And as you get to the third or fourth issue and you go, wait a minute, this is quite a good idea. There's something more I could do with this. Then you should have the flexibility to start adjusting the way the course of the story is going to go to make room for the stuff that seems to be working or just new ideas that come in that seem to supplement and enhance what you're already doing. So I hope you enjoy it. I hope that I've said something remotely useful in the last half an hour or so of your life when you've been listening to this. Thanks for taking the time to listen to me. Please let us know what you think and enjoy the read. I guess that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening. Goodbye.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey, and mastered by Anna Rubinova. For more original podcasts, please visit ForeverDogPodcast.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Forever Dog Team and liking our page on Facebook.